From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. On this week's episode of Season 18, we have a true justice warrior in the room with us today. I'm joined today by Beth Shelburne. Beth is a journalist, and you may have heard her, and if you haven't, you need to go hear her on Season 4 of the amazing podcast Bone Valley, where her season was titled Ear Witness. I've talked a little bit about it on the show. Other listeners and Janet's mentioned it a couple of times. I wasn't familiar with the case until I reached out to Beth, not just a few days ago, and I have since binged the entire, I couldn't listen to a couple episodes and then go on. I had to know how this thing wrapped up. So first and foremost, Beth, thank you for taking time out of your day to join us.
Thank you so much for this conversation, Bob. It's good to be with you.
First things first, I was confused. Janet was confused. Maybe we're just not paying. Was there an ear witness? Like, did you have a podcast or other reporting you did on this before it was on the Bone Valley feed?
Yeah, there. It was originally released with Lava for Good, the production company also behind Bone Valley, as Ear Witness.
Okay.
In 2023, it was re-released as Season 4 of Bone Valley in the Bone Valley feed.
That yes. Makes sense. Because when I was like talking to Janet, because she had mentioned it, Janet Varney is one of my co-hosts on our follow-up episodes. I was like, didn't you say something? She said, well, I listened to Ear Witness a while. I'm like, well, I'm talking about Season 4 of Bone Valley. She's like, wait, no. I listened to a podcast called Ear Witness. And I was like scrambling and it was, everything I found was same you, same report.
So, same story, same horrific wrongful conviction. Yes.
Oh, and this one is bad. I do wrongful convictions for a living, and I have not been as frustrated as I was with this case, into DeForest Johnson's case, more so than I have been frustrated with, a case in a really long time. This one was, just absolutely no evidence. And manufactured evidence. We'll get it. I don't want to jump ahead, but man, that prosecutor, like the things they were doing, like, are you kidding me? But I'll have you first. Well, first give us a little bit about your background.
Sure. I am right now in Birmingham, Alabama, where I'm based. I was born and raised here. And I was in traditional journalism as a TV news reporter and anchor for 20 years. Before I did the work that I'm doing now. So I lived in a couple different cities around the country on the West Coast and New England. And I came back to Birmingham in 2010 to work for the largest TV station in the state here, WBRC in Birmingham. And through that job began reporting on Alabama's criminal justice system, if you want to call it a system. You know, mainly the human rights crisis in our jails and prisons, but also some of the policies behind our over-incarceration, including the death penalty. And so that is how I came into DeForest Johnson's case and my coverage of it, which started back in 2019 with just a simple assignment to cover a court hearing where he was presenting evidence in front of a judge here that there had been prosecutorial misconduct in his case. I didn't cover the case when the crime happened in 1995. I was in college a couple hours away. I didn't know anything about the case when I got the assignment. I, looked over what they were claiming. I knew the basic bare bones facts of the case. And I talked to a couple of his family members ahead of the hearing who were all telling me he was innocent, but I didn't know. Mm-hmm. I had no idea. So I showed up to that court hearing and I've been covering his story ever since then. Since 2019.
I always love to hear the stories of how we get from, especially from traditional journalists, how we get from there to podcast land. But just a little spoiler for you, listen, this is a case where we're talking about where, at least at the end of Season 4, you have the original prosecuting attorney, the current prosecuting attorney, pretty much everyone with it. And I say it's because you mentioned the state having a problem. Everybody within this county and jurisdiction is saying DeForest Johnson, at the very least, deserves a new trial. Like I said, even the original prosecutor, and at the state level, they're still fighting stopping that from happening.
That's right. It's a little similar to Richard Glossop's case, where you've got some diametrically opposed positions from people in power on the validity of the case. But I have never seen a case anywhere, and we've looked, where the original trial prosecutor who argued in front of a jury that DeForest Johnson should die for the crime and got that conviction, sent him to death row, comes back and says, I'm not comfortable with this conviction and he at least deserves a new trial. We've never found that anywhere.
And that's such a wild ride, too, because you talk to him, unless I was mixing up people, you talk to him earlier in the podcast. Mm-hmm. And he's certainly not giving you that impression then. And then by the end of it, for him to come all the way around, that's great. Before we jump into that, though, so how did you, once you start reporting on it, because some of the reporting you did from 2019 ends up living in the podcast mm-hmm. from that original hearing. So how did you get from, you know, going to that hearing for another assignment to creating this great podcast?
Well, I ended up leaving traditional journalism that year, not just to work on DeForest Johnson's story, but to do independent projects and pursue, you know, any kind of long form storytelling. Because as you know, these stories are difficult and they deserve time and attention and rigor. And you just can't really do that in a daily newsroom. Mm-hmm. And so I was immersed in DeForest's case at the time, and I thought very early on that it would be a great story to unpack in a narrative podcast series. Mm-hmm. Just because there's so many twists and turns, it's so confusing. And so even just giving an elevator pitch is hard with this story. Because there's all these different people. There were four trials. There were two different suspects. There were all these different theories that the state presented. There's no forensic evidence, so it's a purely circumstantial case. And so really very slowly and methodically unpacking that while also pursuing the question of how is this guy still down there when all these people and the list of people has grown after Ear Witness came out believe that this conviction is BS. And so, you know, after I covered that hearing in 2019, I asked the attorneys who are representing DeForest now if I could read the trial transcripts. And I, you said you binged the series in 2 days. I read all four trials in one weekend.
Wow.
The two trials that the state put DeForest under and then his co-defendant who was acquitted, who, by the way, was able to pay and retain the best criminal defense attorney in capital cases across Alabama back in 1998. And, you know, you get what you pay for. He was acquitted. Right. So after I read all four trial transcripts, I was like, this case is absolutely bananas. I can't believe this guy is on death row. I really want to pursue this. And then I kind of worked on his legal team. You know, would you guys support this? Would this be helpful to DeForest? I didn't want to do anything that accelerated his execution. And so it took them a while to say yes, but they said, you know, I earned their trust and they said, yeah, go for it. And it turned out to be beneficial because we found a bunch of things that they didn't know when they had that hearing in 2019.
Yeah. And you were able to get incredible access. I mean, you're talking to the original detective, the original prosecutor, the new prosecutor. I mean, yeah, the amount of legwork you did in this is admirable. So did you end up, did you put it together? Did you pitch it to Jason Flom and the team at Lava for good before you made it? Or had you kind of made it and then?
No, we pitched it. I did that initial reporting in 2019. And then I did some follow-up stories with WBRC on some of the issues that his case amplifies, like paying a witness a reward payment.
Right.
What does the law say that, you know, is required when there's a reward payment involved in a case? That's not illegal, but you have to tell everybody that the witness is paid. That's the problem with DeForest's case is they hid that for almost two decades, that the key witness was paid. Through that reporting, I had recorded some conversations. And with my producer, we just put together a little 15-minute sizzle reel pitch and found Jason's work and what he's done on his Wrongful Conviction podcast and some of the narrative series that they were putting out. And so we pitched it to them and they loved it and gave us the funding and support to do it.
Yeah, you Jason and Gilbert, that whole team over there is just so incredible, especially when it comes to a case like this, where like there's a genuine injustice and something needs to be done. So let's back up and kind of walk us through like the basic beats of the case itself as to what happened.
Yeah. So this involves the murder of a beloved sheriff's deputy in Jefferson County. He was moonlighting as a security guard at a local hotel overnight, and he had done this for years. The hotel was in a suburb and was kind of a quiet place, a business hotel. It was an Embassy Suites, or it is an Embassy Suites now. Back then, it was called the Crown Sterling Suites. He would kind of sit in the atrium and smoke for much of his shift because it was so quiet, but he would do some rounds. And when he'd go outside and do rounds along the perimeter of the property, he would get into his squad car. So he did something really unusual right before he was killed. He was sitting in the hotel's atrium, smoking like he usually did and drinking a cup of coffee. And he got up and walked to the back door of the hotel, which opened up into a very small parking lot with like some dumpsters and the loading dock. I mean, it wasn't a part of the hotel that many people were going to. And he walked out the back doors of the hotel and someone shot him twice in the head. Couple weird things about that. He left his two-way radio on the table. He left a cigarette that he was smoking burning in the ashtray, which I've always thought was really noteworthy because he typically would walk around with the cigarette in his mouth. So it always seemed to me that it was like he was going outside for a very specific reason, not to get killed, maybe to meet someone or to check out something that he heard, but very out of character for him to leave his two-way radio. There were no eyewitnesses. It was just before 1 a.m. when it happened, and just a couple people in the hotel heard the gunshots and saw a car driving away. So this was a real whodunit. Police had very little to go on. There was no clear motive. You know, why would this guy wind up dead in the middle of the night behind the hotel where he worked as a security guard? And so law enforcement was really scrambling. And you know how it is when a cop is killed, there's a big public demand and appetite to bring somebody to justice. People are upset. This is like, you know, a member of our community who's here to protect us and someone killed them. And so they started rounding up, you know, anybody who was in the area that night and bringing all kinds of people in, and nothing was sticking. And this went on for like a week or two, until they announced that there was a reward that the governor was putting up. And then people started calling with tips. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of where everything went haywire. And that's what we unpack in the episodes, is the initial witness who came forward, who was a 15-year-old, kind of very troubled street person, who police interviewed 25 times during the length of the investigation and who changed her story over and over again. She was the initial tipster that led to Tafora's arrest and the arrest of four other people. When she fell apart as a witness and they were taking cases to trial, the state called another witness who is the ear witness in Tafora's case and the ear witness in the story. And this was a woman who came forward after the reward was announced, who claimed she overheard a jailhouse phone call in which she says Tafora's confessed to the crime. And that is the crux of the state's case against Tafora's.
It's pretty much all of the state's case by the time they.
That's it. It is the testimony of an ear witness. The phone calls were not recorded at that time. So really, the case rests on the credibility of this one witness. And, you know, her credibility throughout the life of ear witness really goes down the drain. And things that we discover, you know, the worst of which is that the state paid her money to testify and did not disclose it, but lots of other things that were not clear about this woman, her motives, her background, that call her credibility into serious question.
You know, and the motive part is, if I can back up a minute, is one of the things that frustrated me most as an investigator listening to the podcast was you spent quite a bit of time interviewing. Is it Richardson? Is that the name of the lead?
Yes, the lead detective.
The lead detective. You know, as we said, there's no apparent motive for the murder, but it doesn't appear I've always been taught from the time I started learning to be an investigator, step one is victimology. Learn everything you can learn about the victim. And they never did that. You brought it up to him in an interview. And you said, could there have been another motive out there? And he just blew it off. Like, no, he's a cop. He's a cop. There's no reason to check out his victim. He didn't say the word, but what he was saying was, we don't need to look at victimology because he's a cop. So it had to be that, you know, he interrupted a drug deal or something because he was a cop doing cop things. And that's the only thing that we need to care about.
He absolutely said that on the record. He admitted that, you know, unless there was a smoking gun, I would have never looked at his background because he was a police officer and he was killed because he was a police officer. He was convinced that was why he was killed. We went back and did an audit of all of the media coverage of this case. We pulled every single video clip we could get, went into the archives, got every newspaper article. Within hours of this crime being committed, the sheriff at the time told reporters, well, this must have been a drug deal gone bad. Mm-hmm. I had never seen evidence other than, you know, what this 15-year-old witness said at some point when they were questioning her, that this was potentially a drug deal. But no evidence, no real evidence points to that. But it's kind of like the theory that they throw out, if there is no other theory.
Yeah.
It remains.
And so when we get into the prosecution of the case or the investigation and prosecution, there, like, my take on this case was, and I've done some reading on it aside from the podcast too, is that there, you have, like, there's corruption on so many levels here. You have, in my opinion, I won't put those words in your mouth, there was some corruption on the detective's part and what they did with Yolanda Chambers. You know, her story didn't change 25 times on her own. She literally testified to that. To the fact that the police were putting pressure on her to change her story over and over again. So you have the detectives, that there seems to be some corruption there. You have both witnesses have credibility issues. There's some corruption there. Then you have the prosecutor, you know, hiding the ball with the reward money. And then the thing I want to talk about, and I know I'm jumping ahead, but it's been making me insane since I heard it. For those of you that aren't familiar with the case, so as Beth mentioned, there was four trials, you know, so they keep trying and changing theories in front of the jury to try to get a conviction. So ultimately, DeForest gets convicted, sentenced to death as the person who shot Bill Hardy.
Yes.
And, you know, the prosecutor's theory that he presents to the jury is he did it. He pulled the trigger. He shot him. He killed him. Mm-hmm. And then after they obtain that conviction, the same prosecutor, he then takes Ardragus to trial for capital murder and tells the jury he pulled the trigger, he did it. Now, that's, like, on its face, that's frustrating, but when you dig into what that means, so, like, for both of them. So here is DeForest sitting in prison, getting ready to be executed because he's the one that pulled the trigger on the and murdered Bill Hardy. While he's sitting there awaiting his execution, the same prosecutor is now telling a jury that a different person did it. I mean, that's insane. He's telling the jury it wasn't DeForest that did this. This guy did it. Meanwhile, DeForest is waiting to be executed for doing the thing you're saying that someone else did. It's bananas.
I'm so glad that you brought that up because of all of the sort of moral rot that this exposes. That part of it has bothered me almost more than anything else.
Yeah.
That, you know, that this prosecutorial team got their conviction. You know, they told the witness they were going to pay her. They got her to take the stand and say everything that she said, which, by the way, was so not what she originally came and told police.
Right.
In her original statement, you know, when she took the stand, it's suddenly this, like, very ornate memory of DeForest saying, I shot the fucker in the head and he shouldn't have gotten in my shit. She never said that when she first came to police. But they get their conviction. They send Taforis to death row. And then they come back and seat another jury and argue a different theory months later.
It's crazy.
And I really tried to push Jeff Wallace on that. You know, there is no way that you could have believed both were true. And I mean, I'm sure you heard him sort of deflecting and saying, well, the law allows you, and the law does allow this. That's the really bonkers part.
But right.
Aside from that, okay, the law allows a lot of things that are
and allow is used kind of loosely too, because it doesn't, you know, it doesn't say you can do this. It feels like when the laws were written, nobody considered some jackass would do this.
I know.
You know, yeah. It's like it was. Who would As think of something like being, this?
You know, yeah. I remember asking him, you know, how do you square this as a human being that you are telling one jury a story after you told a different story months prior that sent Amanda death row? And he said, I don't have to square it. I have to present the evidence that we have. I mean, it was always, you know, sort of trying to hit a moving target, having this conversation with him.
Yeah.
And I will say, you know, Jeff Wallace isn't the villain in this story. I don't think that there's one villain. We really wanted to do an autopsy on the system mm-hmm. that was working as it's designed to work. He just happened to be the prosecutor of this case. And Tony Richardson just happened to be the investigator of this case. And both of them, I'm grateful, were willing to sit down with me because I think we learned a lot about their minds and how they work and how they don't square a lot of things. And that's okay. I do think both of them have a lot going on underneath the surface that went unsaid that brought them to the microphone. And, you know, listeners can make their own determination. There are a lot of people that were totally disgusted with Jeff Wallace. And then some people, mostly lawyers, who said, you know, he didn't have to say any of that. And he did. And that's true, too. So there's a lot that listeners have to kind of grapple with in this story, because there's not like an easy answer. There's not one villain. And unfortunately, the case is still ongoing. So the injustice continues. That's another thing people have to sit with.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's like I said up front, there's so many layers to how this happened to Forrest. The prosecutor is just one of those layers. And it's, you know, people ask all the time, you know, what are we, all of us that do this type of work in the podcast space and documentaries and all the wrongful conviction work and justice warrior work that happens now, if it's effective? And this is one of the reasons I maintain that it is, because I feel like, you know, when this is happening in the 90s, no one's considering, Jeff Wallace wasn't considering that there's going to be anyone that is going to call him on the carpet for it. And
right.
that it's going to get broadcast, you know, to millions of people around the entire world. Whereas now, I think any prosecutor, and I've talked to, I actually just talked to a guy I know that's a prosecutor that I had on the show recently, just the other day, I ran into him, you know, and they've said that, yeah, they do consider, there are real conversations about when they're deciding what to do, that someone's going to pick, this is going to be a podcast, is the joke
yeah.
that Chris, that my friend that I just ran into, he's like, anytime something bad's going on in court, that's what they always say. It's like, this is going to end up being a podcast if we don't square this up. But
yeah.
It was, like I said, the access you were able to get was incredible. But it's also frustrating listening to yeah. Wallace, like, try to explain that away. Because, you know, that's on Tafora's side. He's on death row for something that the prosecutor is saying someone else did. But then, you know, for Ardragas is on trial trying to get sent to death row, knowing that the guy standing up there telling all these people that I did it a couple months ago stood up there and told people that someone else did it.
I know. It's such a wild headspace to get into, that all of these things can be true at the same time. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just for people that aren't proximate to the justice system, if they've never been arrested, they've never gone to trial, they don't know anybody that has. It sounds like hyperbole, and, you know, they'll say, oh, everybody says that they're innocent. Well, no, not really. I talk to a lot of people in prison, and most don't. They don't say mm-hmm. that they're innocent. But there are people that do get railroaded and end up in prison for something they didn't do. And sometimes they end up on death row. Sometimes we execute them. Yeah. And I think we have a system that refuses to self-correct, particularly in Alabama. And you're right. The fact that we are here having this conversation is progress. It's not what we want to see, that DeForest walks out of home in prison and comes home to his family, but that there is a public appetite for these kinds of stories. People want to know what the truth is. And it's exposing, you know, many things that have gone on in our system for decades that, you know, folks just don't know about if they don't have to know about it.
Yeah. I mean, before your reporting on this, I'm wondering, you know, if there was even in, you probably did this research, was there any like reporting on the fact that he was like presenting these two alternate theories?
No.
Back at the time it was happening?
No. There was, the trials were covered by local media, but it was very, there wasn't any real critical thinking and analysis done on what was happening. It was simply reporting what was happening.
Yeah. And at that time, there wasn't this much more, you know, now we have much more of an acceptance of the idea that the wrongful convictions can happen, I think, in large part due to the media that's out there now. But yeah, I feel like nobody's asking those questions. Nobody's pointing out those facts. So that was exactly what you said, is that what I expected, that people are probably like, oh, well, this guy's on trial for this murder. And there's nobody writing in their story, this is wild because he said somebody else did it a couple months ago. Nobody. So it just goes unnoticed until
now. I think that's kind of the beauty of the podcast ecosystem. I mean, I think it's very particular with podcasts. It's certainly also true with documentary work. It creates a permission structure for people to say, like, what the hell is going on?
Right.
You know, traditional media just hasn't. I mean, they being, you know, the network affiliate TV stations and the big newspapers, generally speaking, are quite deferential to the systems that we have in place. And if they're not, they get accused of being biased, justice warriors, you know, leftists, all those things. So glorifying criminals. I mean, I've been accused of all of it.
Yeah.
It's not about any of that. It's about, you know, asking real questions to real stories that have impacted people and trying to get to the truth. And it's very complex. Our court system and our legal system does not present things as complex. It's black and white, right and wrong. Right. You know, this is true and this is not true, and he's guilty. And there's so much theatrics and performance involved in it, especially at trials. You know, we need to question that. What is that about? What are we doing?
Yeah, because it's particularly in wrongful conviction work, once the conviction is secured, it is so, and you point this out, is so incredibly difficult to overturn a conviction because of the way the rules are set up. And this case is an excessively frustrating example of that. Where, I mean, quite literally everyone involved from all sides is like, this conviction can't stand.
Except for the attorney general in Alabama.
Right. Once we get up to the state level, then that's when they hold it in place. And like you said, there's no rule in place that says you can't tell one jury that something happened and then tell the next jury something. But there are rules in place. I'm sure you didn't get into this, but I'm assuming there are rules in place where at that second trial that the defense isn't allowed to bring up the fact.
Right.
That
is rule. Yes.
What happened in the previous trial.
That's right.
So it's such a weird paradox because it's like you have this carte blanche to do whatever you want as a prosecutor. And then the defense is handcuffed to like, can I at least let the jury know that, you know, 8 weeks ago you were saying that somebody else did it?
Yeah, I know.
But you're not allowed to do that.
Because that is true. You know,
right.
It's part of like the bigger picture story. I think also, you know, there has been in prosecutors' offices across our country, particularly at the state level when they're defending capital cases in death penalty states, they view their job as protecting the conviction.
Yeah.
And I think we have to ask, like, at what cost? I mean, I understand that we have an adversarial system. And so, you know, you do need some kind of guardrails in place when a jury votes on a case. But I think that we're all human beings and, you know, the truth has got to prevail somewhere. It shouldn't be we preserve this no matter what, and we're not going to listen to anything. And that's sort of the way it has worked in Alabama. Is it doesn't matter how outrageous the case is, the attorney general's office is going to dig their heels in and say, this conviction should stand. They will oppose any measure, no matter what it is, no matter how many people support it, no matter what the evidence says. And it's not just in DeForest's case, it's in many other convictions. And it's incredibly frustrating as a journalist and as a human being who cares about these folks that are locked up.
They always lean on that term finality of justice. We have to preserve the finality of, and I get so frustrated with that term. It's so, because my question is always, but what does justice mean?
Yeah.
Like you're saying finality of justice. This wasn't justice. Like, so what are you protecting?
And then also, you know, the weaponization of crime victims happens quite a bit in Alabama where, well, you just don't care about victims. What about the victims? I don't think victims, at least the victims that I know and I have interviewed throughout my career, want the wrong person locked up for harming their loved one.
Right.
So I don't think a wrongful conviction serves victims, you know, in the slightest. And most victims, I think, want the truth. So that's another thing that happens quite a bit in politics down here.
You know, I always counter that with, okay, if you're worried about protecting victims, if you arrest the wrong person for a violent act, that means you let, you know, how many more victims did you just create because you let this violent offender that actually did it on the streets? And who else? And how many times do we hear those cases where they finally 20, 30 years later, a conviction gets overturned, DNA proves it was someone else. They arrest that person and find out, oh, they sexually assaulted, murdered, beat, you know, 20 other people over the years that they were free when they should have been locked up to begin with. So, yeah, I don't buy the we're worried about victims argument.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of defensiveness with especially Tony Richardson, but, you know, some other people that I talked to while I was making the podcast. And I think that that's a shame because, you know, we should be willing to look at our actions and it's okay to question yourself. It's okay to not always be right. That's where I think there's not really a structure in place for former prosecutors or current prosecutors or cops even to say, you know what? I don't think we got this one right. You know, from the top down, it's no, you maintain. We say that we did what we were supposed to do.
Right. Except for in Alabama, in this case, they actually did all come around. They did admit that they made a mistake. And it's still, like you said, at the state level, they're stopping it. You know, I don't want to get into, I don't want to give away too much of the podcast, but there, so I want to kind of talk about a couple things that weren't addressed in it. Because you, I was telling you before we started recording, you know, as someone that's covered trials and stuff like this for so long too, I'm like, well, what about this? What? And you answer every one of those questions along the way. The only couple of them I had were, you talked a lot about the challenge in the Brady challenge because of the payment that was that was made to Violet, the witness. And that wasn't disclosed. A couple other things that I just heard in listening that was wondering if they ever came up in post-conviction relief or an appeal. Or like one, was there ever an ineffective assistance of counsel claim made? Because you mentioned that at the trial where DeForest gets convicted, they didn't bring up the alibi witnesses. Like they just, the defense attorneys just sounds like they completely shit the bed in that second trial.
Yeah, it was bad. And I reached out to both of them. They are both still practicing here in Alabama. Neither one of them would speak to me on the record, and both were pretty defensive. The ineffective assistance of counsel claim in Alabama is very hard to pull off because we have an extremely cozy court system. We don't have a statewide public defender. And so while this is supposed to be an adversarial system, you know, the appointed attorneys, the ones that get appointed to cases, they're all friends with everybody. And so it's got, you know, you can sense that just sitting in a courtroom in Alabama. It's like, what's going on? Everybody's yucking it up like it's cocktail hour. That's kind of part of our culture. But they did, his attorneys Tavoris attorneys post-conviction did file an ineffective assistance of counsel, and it didn't go anywhere. I mean, it went to a hearing, but the judge did not, you know, find that there was merit there.
Yeah, and Strickland's always
admitted, you know, that they dropped the ball. And in fact, one of them, the one that was the assistant attorney in the case, signed an affidavit saying he thought they were ineffective, but the court still said, no, this was adequate.
Yeah. And that's always a tough one to, you know, because they could always, the state will always claim it was trial strategy. There was a strategy reason why they did. I mean, this one seemed pretty egregious, especially because was it his first trial that the jury voted like 10-2 to acquit?
Yeah.
when they declared a mistrial.
Yeah.
And then so you have the playbook, and then the next trial it's like, well, let's not call all these people that worked last time. And then calling Yolanda is bananas. I mean, I'll let everybody get into all that.
It's it really is bananas. You have to wonder what the hell they were thinking. Another thing that I thought was bananas that they didn't do was call the hotel witness, which we interview in the first episode.
Right.
Keebler Cookie guy, who was Marshall Kelly Cummings, who was staying at the hotel, looked out the window and saw one person get into a car that did not match the car that DeForest was in that night and drive away. That was not, you know, that didn't line up with the state's theory, which included DeForest and Ardragus and other people in a very loud Monte Carlo peeling out of the parking lot. They called Marshall Kelly Cummings in the first trial, and DeForest was, it was a hung jury. Second trial, they didn't call him, and he didn't know why they didn't call him, and they had no explanation for why they didn't call him. But it was enough, I think, in the first trial to create enough reasonable doubt for some of those jurors to say, I don't think this is it.
Well, yeah, that's why it didn't make any sense, because the state's entire case is this hearsay witness saying she overheard something. There's nothing to corroborate it.
No.
The only way to defend against that is two ways. One, to attack her credibility if you can, and then to just insert enough reasonable doubt. And they had solid alibi witnesses. They had witnesses from the scene that saw a different vehicle in a different situation, and they didn't call any of them. The only other thing that's really nagging at me, and I was getting real excited when you brought it up, but you weren't able to really pin it down. I was just curious if you got any further. As we were hearing about Violet and her son and that whole connection and her being witnesses in all these other cases, I was sitting there thinking, I'm like, I wonder if she made a deal for her son. I bet she made a deal for her son. And then we find out that this is no small, as you know. You know, her son was sentenced to 15 years in prison, and then, which is a few weeks or months before DeForest's trial, and she testifies, that gets reduced to probation. Now, I know you mentioned it was in a different county, but like, I'm from small town Michigan. Like, it's nothing for the attorneys and DAs in this county to call the people in the county next door to, you know, work something out and do favors. But I know you weren't able to, at least on the podcast, to prove anything or make any more connection to that. It's just to put it in the category of things that make you go, hmm.
Yeah, but yeah. There was a lot of smoke there. And, you know, clearly more than one person, multiple people telling us that how Violet Ellison operates is always trying to protect her son, who is a very troubled person who's been in and out of jail his whole adult life. We also know that there was some coziness with some police officers, but we just were not able to really find any kind of proof of that. It was just, you know, people telling us, but multiple people kind of telling you the same story. It starts to build a character portrait of somebody. So no, we were not able to find any proof that a deal had been worked out. But we're still looking. We're still like open, you know, for anybody that may have information about the case. And, you know, I know DeForest is hoping that, you know, more people will come forward with information.
Yeah. And I'm sure if you did, he would have denied it. But I'm curious, did you ever pose that question to Wallace? Just ask him, did you make a deal with Violet?
So we talked to Jeff Wallace multiple times during the making of the podcast. And you mentioned, you know, in the first interview seems like very staunchly a little defensive of the conviction. And in the last episode, really seems like he's come around.
Yeah.
He did go on a journey with us. And I do appreciate him for that and agreeing to meet with us and was curious about what we found. He wouldn't listen to recordings about Violet and,
right.
you know, he wouldn't go all the way. You know, he wouldn't carry the ball all the way into the end zone. And he, in fact, said, I'm not going to say this guy is innocent. I know you want me to say that. And I'm like, well, I mean, but do you believe that? You know, he felt, I think, a little bit like we were backing him into a corner. I remember telling him, look, the last interview I did with him, I'm going to show you what we found about Violet Ellison. And I was like, she was a witness in this case, this case, this case, this case, and this case. Here's how it lined up with DeForest's trial. It was in this courthouse. Your trial was in this courthouse. They were within 1 month. He was like pale. And, you know, you could just see kind of the color drain out of his face. And he said, I had no idea any of this was going on. And we believed him. I mean, there's a lot of people that work in the courthouse. The DA at the time held a lot of power. He had, I think, 50 prosecutors working for him. So I think it's plausible that he didn't know. I think, you know, you could argue, well, he was getting caught at something. Maybe that's the case. I can't recall if I asked him if he made a deal. He was insistent that he didn't have anything to do with the reward payment. And that wasn't something that line prosecutors took care of. That came straight from the elected DA.
Mm-hmm.
And office. And of course, we reached out to the elected DA and he's like, I don't know anything about that. Nobody right. wanted to own up to facilitating the reward. Jeff Wallace, the original prosecutor, was not involved in any of those other cases that Violet Ellison was a witness in.
Mm-hmm.
With other prosecutors, most of them in another courthouse. He did say, you know, does DeForest attorneys know this? Does the current DA know this? He wanted to make sure that we elevated all of that. And
right.
the answer to that was yes, but no.
Yeah, his very real character arc throughout the story is interesting. And it's encouraging even that he finally does come around and we're left. He's to an extent comes around.
Yeah,
we're left at the end of the podcast with, you know, DeForest cases. You know, the AG is fighting. You have the current DA, the original DA that are, and of course, all the defense that are all saying this conviction needs to be overturned. There needs to be a new trial at the very least. And the attorney general's office is fighting that. And that's kind of where we leave off at the end of the season. Has there been any progress since then or what's going on now?
DeForest attorneys filed an updated motion for a new trial in 2024 with a new judge. The judge that denied the Brady claim in 2019 retired, and she actually passed away a couple years ago. But this is a new judge who took over her seat. And, you know, it's been a year and a half, I think, since they filed it, and there hasn't been any movement. So we do have a change in administration happening. Here statewide in November, we'll have a new governor, we'll have a new attorney general. And so, you know, politics, unfortunately, impacts these cases. And so that might be what the weight is. I don't know. But, you know, that's where things stand. He also has, you know, some other appeals. People will ask, like, how much time does he have? I mean, he's been on death row for 25 years. Mm-hmm. So he doesn't have a whole lot of time, but there are some active appeals that have to be resolved before the state would ever be able to, you know, take out a warrant for his execution. So he's got a little bit of time, but not much.
Okay. Well, we will definitely stay tuned. I'm sure if there are any updates that we'll get updated episodes, Ear Witness on Bone Valley. So that is just our discussion here is just barely scratching the surface of this case. And you guys, my audience knows, you know, anytime I'm doing these interviews, I listen to as much as I can and do some research so I can do this. This was one of the cases where, you know, I got two episodes into Ear Witness and couldn't stop and binged the entire season in 2 days, not in preparation for the interview, just because I had to see how this story unfolded. It's very good. Check it out. That's season 4 of Bone Valley, Ear Witness. And Beth, thank you so much for joining me and thank you for your great work on this case.
Thank you so much, Bob. I appreciate the kind words about the series and for this conversation and the work that you do. Thanks.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kay Wood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X at Truth Justice Pod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.